Ah, well, thank you, and I'll be fast so we can get to the beer. I don't drink beer myself, but there's other alcohol out there. In fact, I'm wondering, you know, actually this brings up to mind, I'm going to get to my talk in a second, but does alcohol diminish positive symptoms? That's a GABA. That ups a GABA, so you might think that could also do it. What I'm going to do is I'm going to try and make everybody happy or everybody mad, especially Edmund. But because I'm going to have an inverted U, I'm going to have some firing rate or mean field models. I'm going to have some oscillations, and I'm going to have some working memory, okay? And dopamine, okay? So anyway, this is essentially a copy of Nancy's slide. Many diseases are dynamic in the sense that they're a consequence of breakdown in normal feedback regulation. I think some of the ones that were last week or this week earlier, Parkinson's disease. I don't know if anybody's doing migraines. I think there's an epilepsy one, or maybe it's already happened, and schizophrenia. And the cortex, of course, itself is highly controlled via multiple negative feedback pathways. Here's a pointer. And there's a lot of these. Does the pointer work? Oh, I'm just hitting a little. There we go. There, sorry. I was hitting the label that said pointer. Okay. So too much play around with the iPad. All right. And I also apologize if I'm a little hoarse. 2 days ago, I was at a six-hour rock concert, and still, you know, you yell a lot, just trying to talk to people. Anyway, so lots of negative feedback, spike frequency adaptation, synaptic depression, synaptic inhibition, and also on longer timescales, homeostatic controls. So this is a paper taken from David, okay, about local circuits altered in schizophrenia. I won't go through all these because he basically gave a very nice intro to this about reduced GABA expression in PV or fast spike units, alteration of the NMDA receptors, and upregulation of some slower receptors, as well as changes in reversal potential, among other things. There's lots of interesting things that happen to the local circuitry. Here's an oscillation, okay, gamma increases during working memory. So here's an example of gamma power increase during the delay period in a working memory task. This is from about 9 years ago, so it's probably not true anymore. that's a little, I know, it's a jab at biologists. Yeah, I got to insult everybody at least once. Okay, so POP is a test that Ray Cho and other people use to test working memory. It's called Preparing to Overcome Prepotency. Let me tell you what the task is, okay? What happens is a little color will come up, a green square or a red square, and if the green square comes up, then you're supposed to respond with your right hand if the arrow points right and your left hand if the arrow points left. And if the red square comes up, you respond in the opposite direction. And so that people, you have to kind of remember what the color was, and then from that you have to decide what to do. And there's gamma during this task, okay? And this is in controls, and this is patients. And this is from Cho et al, 2006. And if you look in normal controls versus patients, there's an increase in the gamma in the preparing to overcome prepotency task in controls relative to the patients. So one of the thoughts was that this impairment of gamma, and this is seen in a lot of other studies too, an impairment of gamma oscillations during certain cognitive tasks in working memory. Okay, so people interpret this as follows. They interpret it as, since gamma depends on inhibition, and we've seen that from Nancy's talk and stuff that's been done over many, many years, and working memories associated with increases in gamma. And schizophrenia patients show decreased gamma and impaired working memory and altered local GABA circuitry, that we could indirectly link inhibition and schizophrenia very tightly. Okay, so that's one thing that you can, one immediate take-home lesson you could take here. Now what I want to talk about is a couple of different models of that we've done over the last couple of years. Some of these are with a new grad student, Kubra Komak. That's going to be dopamine and what dopamine could do to inhibition. So I'm going to talk about that, and I'm going to get a nice inverted U for Albert. Okay? And then the second thing, I won't give you the previews. You take the time to give the talk. Okay, so anyway, just like Albertosol, cortical activity is optimal in a limited range of 5-HT. It's also limited in a limited range of dopamine. Cognitive performance is poor at extremes of dopamine concentrations. That is, at low cases, as in schizophrenia, and at high, as in acute stress. Okay. Similarly, so one way that dopamine may affect cognitive abilities is through its effect on cortical rhythms. Or maybe the cortical rhythms are just showing that could be simply, this is an issue that I'm going to try and convince Ed that may not necessarily be true. It could be that the rhythms are an epiphenomena of messing up the inhibition. But I like to think that there is some utility to these rhythms as well. So in any case, this is a study that Ray did, Ray Cho, amphetamines and gamma. And what he did is he recorded EEG from normal and schizophrenic subjects during a 40 hertz auditory click stimulus. This is a very common protocol in schizophrenia research. Nancy's written some papers on these click stimuli, and both were given amphetamines, which increased dopamine levels. In patients, gamma increased while normal controls decreased. Okay? And there's also associated with this a similar shift in cognitive behavior. It turns out that schizophrenics do better if they're given amphetamines in some cognitive tasks, and normal people do worse. To some extent. Obviously, we all know that, you know, a little speed will get you through your homework. I guess this is filmed, so I have to be really careful. Just say no, okay? I just finished watching the third season of Breaking Bad, so I'm well aware of amphetamine interests. Okay, so anyway, here's an example, all right? So this is the placebo, and here's the amphetamine. This is the controls, all right? And there you see a nice big, this is during the stimulus. Zero is the time of the stimulus. You see this nice big gamma band there. And then when you add the amphetamines, this is decreased. Similarly, here's the patients. The downside of the iPad. It reminds you of all sorts of things. Okay, I'm glad it's not trash night. So with the patients, you get a diminished amount of gamma during this task, and then with the amphetamines, you get a big increase. All right? So what we wanted to do was come up with a simple model for how to explain this. So we suppose that one of the mechanisms through which dopamine alters cognition is through modulation of gamma. But how? I mean, Dave Turman put up a slide last spring at the SIADS meeting that had like 43 different effects of dopamine on the brain, okay? So we're going to pick one of those, all right, here, all right? So Gorelova et al. In 2002 found that, among other things, dopamine changed the potassium leak in inhibitory interneurons. So this is very similar to what Albert was saying. One of the effects of 5-HT was it changed, or one of the effects of the 5-HT is it changed the leak in, I don't know which cells it changed the leak in, but this is very specific to the FSUs. So what we hypothesized is that this could clearly alter the excitability of the FSUs, which could in turn alter gamma. And as Nancy pointed out, gamma really has a very limited, there's a limited range of parameters for which gamma will work well. And if you have too much of something or too little of something, too little inhibition or too much inhibition is bad. So we're just basically going to do essentially what she just pointed out. So we're going to use the Wang-Buzaki model. That's a well-known model for inhibitory interneurons for a first fast spike unit. And we vary GK leak. All right. And so this is just a little bifurcation diagram. Along here is applied current. Along here is the frequency in kilohertz, because I forgot to multiply by 1,000. Okay. So what you see here is as I change the GK leak, I move the threshold back. Okay. It's much easier to get these guys to spike with lower GK leak. So you can think of the normal GK leak is somewhere around right here, and then I'm increasing it, decreasing it, and making the network or the neuron more excitable. All right. So what I'm going to do is my first network is going to be 50 excitatory cells based on the TRALB plus a calcium-dependent potassium current. I'm going to add 20 inhibitory neurons. Heterogeneous drive to the E cells and additive Gaussian noise to both. You know, you always throw noise in. It's all coupling with random strength of the coupling, but everybody's coupled to everybody. And I'm going to apply tonic drive in the spontaneous gamma case, and then filtered 40 hertz periodic drive in the click model. So I'm going to do two things here. First, I'm going to show you what happens if I just add tonic drive, sort of like what they do in the slice where they add kainate or they add carbachol or something so that this guy is going on its own. Okay? And then I'm going to do the same thing, but I'm not going to add any tonic drive. I'm just going to hit this with clicks. Okay? So I don't know if you can see this, but what I varied here is the leak conductance along here. So this is low excitability, less dopamine, high excitability, more dopamine. And right here is the strength of coupling of the inhibition to excitation. Excitation to inhibition. Yeah. Normally, and this has always been I've always written GIE to mean inhibition on to excitation, and GEI to mean excitation on to inhibition. But physicists say that's backwards because you don't multiply matrices GIJ, okay? And so I switched to this, and I'm always confused now. So in most of this talk, it's physicist notation, for which I have infinite contempt. Okay. So anyway, so that aside, all right, so what I want to show you is depending on your choice of parameters, but over a wide range of them, you get a nice non-monotonic range of gamma power as I vary the excitability. So there's an inverted U, okay? So there's an optimal, there's a sweet spot for excitability and gamma. Okay? Just like there was a sweet spot for for working memory and 5-HT. All right? We could do the same thing with periodic drive. And what I'm showing you here is essentially the 40 hertz power as a function of the weak conductance. Okay? And there you can see an inverted U. There's quite a spike there. I'm not sure why that is. I think it's probably because there's not quite enough noise in the system. And these are some rasters. These are the excitatory cells and the inhibitory cells. And this is like just the optimal amount of dopamine. And there you can see very nice gamma. Okay? If the dopamine is too low, the inhibitory cells just don't fire enough. That allows the excitatory guys to fire like crazy. Even though they're getting periodic drive, They're still firing on their own a lot. There is E to E coupling here, and you just get it messes up the gamma. And on the other hand, if you make too much inhibition, then the E cells don't fire at all. They just have too much inhibition. And once they stop firing, then the I cells also break up. So there's this sort of positive feedback and negative feedback, which reduces this thing. So once again, like Albert had, you get this U-shaped curve as we change the leak conductance, and therefore you can think of this as the U-shaped curve that you get with dopamine. Okay, so that's sort of part one. I want to talk a little bit about NMDA and gamma, because we've heard a lot of stuff about, among other things, I think there was a couple of, I think Nancy mentioned this, about disruption of NMDA on the inhibitory interneurons, okay? And there's some thoughts of things like ketamine and other things. I think, is it ketamine? It's the animal tranquilizer that gives people schizophrenia-like symptoms. In any case, what I want to say is there's also kind of a sweet spot for NMDA onto inhibitory cells, although I'm only going to look at one part, I'm only going to look in one direction, a monotonicity thing, because I haven't actually looked at the other part, because we weren't thinking about the sweet spot. We were more, this was an issue that, this is joint work with Rotaru et al. And Guillermo, and I think Dave's on that paper also, 2011, Journal of Neuroscience. And basically what they were doing is measuring in the PFC the amount of NMDA onto the fast spike units. All right? And what they found is that, so what you can do is you can apply AP5, which is a blocker of NMDA, all right? And if you look at the ESP or EPSPs, okay, versus control versus AP5, you can see on the E to E cells, there's a significant drop, okay? So there's a strong NMDA component onto excitatory cells. But they found not a significant amount of NMDA onto the inhibitory FSUs. Now one thing, wait, now this is FSUs, these are not LTS cells, okay? This is in dorsal lateral is it DLPFC, isn't it?
Well, oh.
Okay, RAP frontal cortex. Okay. All right. Dave.
Is this during what? The working memory task or background?
Huh?
Is this during what?
No, this is a slice. This is a slice. Yeah, you can't do these in vivo very easily, I don't think, unless you've got really lots of expensive equipment. Okay? Whereas in FS cells, fast spike cells, there wasn't that much. Okay, so with the caveats aside, that Nancy brought up, we wanted to ask what happens if there's too much NMDA. Yeah. To rat pre. Yeah. Okay. Thanks. All right. So what we did was we made a network of, I think, 200 E cells, 50 I cells. Okay. And what we did was we added extra NMDA onto the I cells. All right. So we have a little bit of NMDA onto the I cells, NMDA receptors onto the I cells, and then we added too much. All right? And of course, I think if you add too little, it will also mess things up, depending on your choice of parameters. All right? And so what we found is This is the power spectral density. This is the frequency. It's around 40 hertz. Okay? And I probably should just blow up this thing, but I wanted to be honest and show you that there is ringing. These are fairly oscillatory networks. Okay? And basically, from this point, there's a kind of monotonic decrease in power as I increase the NMDA. All right? So this is the least amount of NMDA, and that's the most. All right? And basically, what you can see here is you can, if you look at the, if you record the currents going into the inhibitory cell, okay? If you record the currents, and I've shown, I'm showing three things here. I'm showing the green is excitatory cells, and the red is the inhibitory output. Okay? And what you find is that it's, unfortunately, the green isn't so easy to see. Oh, no, no, the black is the total synaptic input going into that particular E cell. And with too much NMDA, you can see it persists a little bit. And that's enough to give you these extraneous eye spikes, which wreck the gamma. Okay? You get too much inhibition. Okay?
Can I just mention, so, I mean, that's effectively the long time constant of the NMDA.
That's exactly right.
Is wiping out the gamma.
That's right.
And so the crucial balance there is between the AMPA and the gamma.
AMPA and the GABA, yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. But NMDA plays a very important role, I think, you'll see in the next thing, in terms of working memory. Okay, and I think Xiaojing, and I don't know whether you were in on, you did some of that too. I know John did on the NMDA and working memory with Xiaojing. Did you guys do stuff on that, or was it you alone? There was this whole Brandeis group there. That anyway, so now what I want to do is.
Huh?
Oh, I did have I to I, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I have I to I, I have E to E, I have E to I, and I to E. They're all there. Now, the problem, of course, with all these networks is that you don't know you don't know what the right numbers are. But as anybody who's ever made gamma will tell you, it's really, really, really easy to get gamma. All you need is excitatory cells and inhibitory cells. So one of the big things is why, you know, what can you do to prevent it, I guess, so now, I guess, what I want to talk about now is, and this is, I guess, the issue that I think the animals nod along with, is gamma a signature or a necessity for any of these things? So clearly gamma is tightly linked to inhibition, okay? There's lots of work that's been done on that, okay? Capel, Spencer, Gonzalez-Borges. Clearly, inhibition is tied to working memory, okay? And you can look at any of the hundreds of papers on, well, I'll call the generalized bump attractor model or ring, there's lots of them, ring models, there's all kinds of models like that. And they all depend on inhibition so that everybody doesn't go up, okay? So could it be that reduced gamma oscillations are just a signature of reduced inhibition and thus just an epiphenomena? Okay? In other words, I think is it Tony Movshin that says gamma is the exhaust fumes of computation? One of those guys said that. I don't remember, but it's another one, the anti-oscillation crowd. Okay? Or could and do oscillations play a fundamental role in working memory? All right? So what I'm going to try and convince you of in the next few minutes is that maybe they do, or they could. So what good are oscillations, okay? I'm probably not defending them as well as I should, and over beer we can ask Nancy to better defend them. But I'm sure you okay, so several hypotheses about the roles of rhythms. One is sort of binding different modalities, and that goes way back to the work of Niebuhr and Walt Schneider and a bunch of other people back in the Christoph von der Malzberg, yeah, back in the 70s or early 80s, and then Charlie Gray and in the 90s and stuff. Okay, another thing that's cool about oscillations is they're really easy to synchronize. If you've got oscillations, you've got this one, you've got this zero eigenvalue. You guys are mathematicians, so I could talk about zero eigenvalues. Okay, that allows you to push them around really easily. Okay, and so it's really easy to synchronize them. Okay, and synchrony is really useful if you want to push information forward upstream from some other thing, all right? Because neurons like coincidence detection, and they will, so synchrony is that. So what about a connection, but what's the connection to working memory? And I first saw there was something there, and looking actually at this paper by Albert and Xiaojing Wang, okay, it's in cerebral cortex, and I usually have a slide of it here, but I don't. And it shows these very nice gamma oscillations during a working memory simulation. Okay, and I think John has also done things like that where there's not enough NMDA in there, okay? And you start to see these oscillations, all right? So I started out with the idea, why bother with oscillations since attractors work fine without them, all right? And, you know, in some sense, I'm agnostic on this because I've done a lot of work on mean field models or firing rate models which don't want oscillations, but I've also done a lot of work on oscillations. But I'm here as a defender of oscillations today, so that's the hat I'm wearing, all right, in spite of what Allah put up. All right, so let me show you a little attractor. So there's an attractor, all right. This slide was made for biologists, so so it's suitably simple. I'm just kidding, sort of. Okay. So now we have two attractors. Okay. Now, if we had two attractors and we wanted to switch from this attractor to that attractor, it'd be very difficult. You have to get all the way up that hill and get back down. Well, it's easy to get back down, but you have to get over this big hump. Okay, so an attractor is great, but it's hard to switch if you're in one. Okay, if you get stuck in the same attractor too much, and I got this idea from Edmund and Gustavo's paper, I think the PLOS computational biology one, and Lowe, I think, is the other author on OCD and things like that. Okay, so if that attractor is, if you get stuck in that, it's hard to get out of that. Okay. But if there's an oscillation associated with that attractor, then every 25 milliseconds, if it's a 40 hertz oscillation, that attractor becomes less deep. Because what is it that makes these attractors deep is the feedback inhibition that acts as a lateral inhibition. It's what holds the other guys down. It prevents this guy. So what's going on here is if that inhibition is periodically modulated, then it might be easier to jump from one to the other. All right? So I'm also going to show you that you might say, well, wait a second, that's going to mess you up because of noise. Okay? And I'm going to show you that it doesn't. All right? But I'm going to use a mean field model to do that. So anyway, so here's an oscillatory attractor. So the idea here is that during working memory, oscillatory attractors might make it easier to switch from one to another, okay, but still maintain robustness in the presence of noise. Okay? So to do that, basically they require enough persistent activity, you require enough persistent activity to overcome the periodic inhibition, okay? And so that's where NMDA plays a big role, all right? Because if all you had was GABA or AMPA and all you had was GABA, okay, the excitation wouldn't persist long enough unless you gave it a drive, okay? So in all these models, okay, the models I'm going to show you now, these guys, like Albert's models, they have a stable background rest state, and then you have to induce a certain number of them up to maintain it, and then they jump up, okay? And the way they do that is through NMDA to the excitatory to excitatory NMDA receptors, because that persists long enough to overcome the inhibition, the wave of inhibition, and allows them to come back up, okay? They can provide a short window of opportunity that's reliable. It obtains every, it occurs every 25 milliseconds. They're robust to noise and to distractors. That's not obvious, but I'll show you some evidence. That is, oscillations make it easier to change your mind and not get stuck. So that's the shtick I'm taking here. All right. So again, building on basically some of the ideas that Ed and Gustavo had, I'm going to build an attractor model, okay? But unlike his model, which you wouldn't have oscillations if you paid it, my model is going to have oscillations in it, okay? So basically, let's suppose I have two attractors. I've got a dark blue attractor and a light blue attractor. What makes these guys attractors is, in the world of other neurons, they have stronger connections between each other, all right, through some Hebbian mechanism or something like that, okay? And there's some overlap, okay? So here's these two guys overlap. And then sprinkled among them are some little red inhibitory neurons, okay? So it's going to be, I'm going to start with a spiking model. The spiking model has two embedded, strongly connected attractors. E cells have adaptation and NMDA, AMPA synapses with some overlap. The inhibitory interneurons provide GABA and receive AMPA and NMDA as well. Okay, there's a stable rest state, and there's evoked gamma. That is, if I stimulate this network, then I get one of these attractors to turn on, and then I start to get oscillations. I don't get them before that. All right, so that's my little model. Here's some equations, all right? For those of you who don't know it, this is the famous theta model. I use the theta model a lot because Nancy and I invented it, so I figure, you got to use your own inventions, okay? So it's basically, for those of you who don't like the theta model but like the quadratic integrating fire model, they are the same, okay? all right? But this is, this is a theta model. I've got inhibitor, all the usual conductances in here. Now you see I've switched to my happy notation, okay, the non-physics notation. So IE means I to E, okay, and EI. Maybe if I were in Israel, I would switch them, because then you read right to left, right, and then it would make sense. Anyway, all right, so... here we go. There's the excitatory guys, there's the NMDA, and these are all the currents, and these conductance strengths are embedded in them are the attractors, okay? So this is, there's no space in this, or there's no spatial distribution, okay? I just have two guys, okay, two attractors. There's a stable background state with little dynamics happening, okay? When a stimulus arrives that close to one of the embedded attractors, the stronger coupling between the units maintains the activity. Strong recurrent inhibition would destroy it, but the NMDA component maintains the persistent activity in the form of a gamma oscillation. Okay, and the oscillations provide moments in time when the inhibition is strong and the attractor is, I think inhibition is weak and the attractor is shallow. Okay? So here's a picture of the normal state, all right? So this is a raster plot, okay? And this is time. And at time t equals 200, I turn on the first memory, okay? And I get these nice oscillations, all right? And at t equals 600, I give an impulse to memory 2, okay, that's sufficiently large, and I switch, all right? And this is a kind of an LFP. And so you can see that the gamma comes on. If you count this, it's roughly 40 hertz. Okay? The gamma comes on when these guys are being held. So it's very similar to Albert and Xiaojing's cerebral cortex in that the region, the group of guys that are on in an oscillatory manner. All right? So that would be my normal, as Nancy said, we should study normal things first and then, or at the same time as pathology. Okay. So now what I want to do is compare an oscillatory attractor to a non-oscillatory attractor. So one way to do that is to make the inhibitory neurons far more noisy and heterogeneous so that they can't oscillate synchronously. They break into an asynchronous state. Okay? So here we go. All right? So this is the same simulation, except now the inhibitory cells are asynchronous. Okay? They're going much more asynchronous. Okay? And what happens is it really takes a very strong stimulus to turn off the other attractor, a much stronger stimulus than with the oscillatory one. All right? So here I could do it with a few milliseconds. Here I had to make the strength much stronger before I switched from this attractor to this attractor. As you can see here, I transiently turned this guy on, but it wasn't enough to overcome the strength of this guy, and he stays on. Okay? And you can see LFP doesn't have a trace of gamma. No oscillations in this LFP. All right? So...
Was the fire rate comparable?
I think, okay, the mean firing rate was, yeah. Actually, you can see it much better when I do the population model, the mean field one, okay? This is really hard to do. It was really hard to make these guys go asynchronous, and they probably do have a higher firing rate, okay? But it was really hard to do that. It's much easier in the mean field. I'm sorry, what? Oh, I put a lot of noise on them and make and weaken the eye-to-eye coupling. And yeah, it's not easy. It's really hard. These guys really want to, you know, they just want to have. Yeah. Hmm? Yeah. Okay. So NMDA to eye matters too. So this is getting more on. So with no NMDA onto the eye, okay, again, it's hard to switch the other guy off because the inhibition doesn't, here, the inhibition isn't that active, all right? There's lots of inhibition skipped. Inhibition is down here, excitation's here, okay? Whereas now the inhibition is fully on, but it's not enough to turn both of these guys off, okay? You need it to be fully on to switch from one to the other. So this doesn't have enough NMDA. There we have just enough, okay? And that's, again, the sweet spot for NMDA. We get nice switching from this attractor to this attractor when the stimulus comes on, okay? Now, another thing that I will freely admit is there's not much background activity here, okay? And this is an issue of using small networks, okay? If you use a much bigger network, you can have a lot more slop in there, okay? But with small networks, you can't. All right. And if there's too much NMDA, okay, here, this is still okay. All right. You can switch from one attractor to the other, all right, as we get more NMDA. But now what happens is if there's too much, okay, then you get too much recurrent inhibition and you just shut off the attractor altogether sometimes, and other times you don't. Okay? So, yeah. The AMPA does matter, and you can change that ratio, but it's really the persistence of, you'll see in just a second, it's the persistence of the NMDA that screws you up. Okay? How much time do I have?
10 minutes.
10 minutes, okay. All right, here, I'll make it into a video. Basically, when GNI equals zero, okay, you get too much excitation, double E spikes before the eye has a chance to come on, all right? And then when the stimulus comes on, there's freedom for, since you can get two E spikes per eye, okay, then you can get them to alternate and both memories will come on, okay, with not enough NMDA, okay? At the sweet spot, okay, one spike per E cell, one spike per I cell, and now the second memory can suppress the first memory and take over, okay? Huh?
Why are you talking about a sweet spot when you showed the graph with no NMDA component onto the inhibitor cells, right? You showed us that prefrontal cortex. So now you're saying that the non-existent thing is important to get to the sweet spot.
I'm sorry, what?
A non-existent, you showed us a slide saying there's a non-existent NMDA component onto the E to I connection, right?
I said there's this one, yes.
No, you showed us a data slide.
Oh, no, I said that there is a small amount. It's
but
much...
It wasn't statistically significant.
Yeah, but it is there. There is some there, right?
Yeah, I think that the finding is that the proportion of NMDA to AMPA current is much larger in granule cells than it is in fast spiking cells.
Okay, yeah.
So there's a little bit there, and that's not
important. Yeah.
Okay.
No, I think it is important. Yeah, it is important, and that's what I was trying to show you here. Okay? So, you know, I'm going to skip the well, this is also builds on some of the things. What happens if you change the I to E connection strength? Okay? So, as you do that, all right, this is the normal case. Okay? Normal switch. And as I decrease I to E, okay, now you can still see that I can make the switch, but I've messed up the LFP. It's no longer oscillatory. So this is sort of in Ed's sweet spot. I can still make the switch, and it's not oscillatory, but I decrease the I to E. All right. As I continue to decrease the I to E, I can get the other guy on, but now both of them are on. So you can think of this as everybody's getting on. Not everybody's turned on yet, but now eventually, no matter what stimulus I get, because of the overlap, it'll automatically turn the other memory on. And finally, if there's really low I to E, we're up there in that seizure regime that Dave alluded to. Okay, everybody turns on as soon as a stimulus comes on, even guys that don't have a working memory. All right, so I'm going to finish up by just showing you a little simple population model, all right? And basically, I took that 50 E cells, 20 I cells with associated synapses and reduced it to a five-dimensional ODE, all right, using just writing a population model, all right? And so there's the equations for the 5D ODE. There's excitatory NMDA inhibitory. So there's 1, 2, J equals 1 and 2 corresponding to the two memories. So there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 equations, okay? And basically, a small stimulus turns on the AMPA NMDA, which creates the attractor. This is exactly the self-coupled system that I think Albert talked about, okay? Okay. Inhibition carves it out, but NMDA maintains it. The stimulus must be strong enough to kick past the inhibition to turn on the other guy and turn off number one with exactly the same amount of inhibition. Okay? So here's kind of a, this picture is really hard to see on the screen here, so I'm going to just skip it. And I'm going to go to what I said about being robust to noise, and then I'll finish up. All right? So I have 5 minutes for questions. All right. And here we go. So this is what happens with oscillatory attractors, okay? And so what I'm ranging from is along this axis is a time constant for my inhibitory population model, all right? Don't think of this as biophysical as anything. What it allows you to do is back here the inhibition is super fast, and so you don't get oscillations. The equilibrium point is stable, all right, with fast inhibition, okay? With slower inhibition, the equilibrium becomes unstable and you get an oscillation, okay? And so what happens, and then with really slow inhibition, the only oscillations possible are synchronous oscillations between all the attractors. Everybody turns on. Okay? So what you want to, what I want to do here is what I'm plotting here is what is the magnitude of the stimulus I need to make a switch from one attractor to another. Okay? And what you see here is here's the amplitude and there's tau. Okay? And up here is a bifurcation diagram as a function of tau. All right? And you can tell this was done with XPP because it's red, green, black, and blue. Anyway, so there is winner take all for low values of tau. All right? So there's a winner take all system. So that's sort of a non oscillatory attractor. Okay? Then that loses stability and you get what I'll call oscillatory winner take all. So one, you get one big oscillation and one little oscillation, and then that becomes unstable through a subcritical, well, that becomes unstable as tau increases to a synchronous oscillation, okay, where both attractors are just going synchronously, okay? So that's a really low tau. All right, so what happens is this is the amount of stimulus it needs to switch. So a winner take all, you need 0.25, and then as the oscillatory nature kicks in, you need less and less and less to kick you to the other attractor where you want to go, okay? And then finally, if the tau is too slow, then synchrony, you automatically go to the other attractor, okay? Now, what about robustness to noise, all right? That's what I said. I mentioned noise, all right? So once again, this is the same picture, essentially. The color coding, light blue is synchrony, both guys in the same state. Red is the attractor state. So the color code is sort of the difference between the state group, attractor one and attractor two. Okay, so a winner take all, it would be red. An oscillatory winner take all, it would be red. And what you can see is, as I move along this axis from winner take all, between the two arrows is where it's an oscillator, okay? You can see that the amount of noise, this is the strength of noise that's needed to switch, okay, is constant. So it doesn't hurt you, okay? The noise doesn't, having in the oscillatory attractor doesn't hurt you. So I'll summarize. Inhibition plays a major role in controlling activity in the cortex, and disruptions of it may be associated with numerous neural pathologies. It's the key player in gamma rhythms associated with perception and other cognitive tasks. Working memory requires both strong positive and negative feedback, both to sustain it and prevent runaway excitation. And I'm suggesting that oscillations allow for robust but flexible working memory. Okay? And further work affects, David talked a little bit about this, effects of increase of GABA amplitude and decrease in time constant. We're working on that right now. Role of chandelier cells in maintaining gamma with depolarizing reversal potential. Further analysis of in-ping and heterogeneity and overall reduction of synaptic inputs. That's another thing. That's a homeostatic idea. So let me finally acknowledge everybody and then I'll call it a day. The Connie Center for Neuroscience of Mental Disorders, funded by NIMH. Ray Cho from psychiatry. Kubra Komak, she's a PNC undergrad, a grad student that's been working with Ray and me. And Guillermo Gonzalez-Borges in psychiatry. And, of course, always the NSF. So that's it. Thanks. Ed.
So that's very stimulating, and obviously it's a nice idea, and I believe the data, that oscillations can help them to jump out of it. The thing is, you're working in a pretty extreme regime. You've got massive oscillations compared to anything you ever see in the brain. So one of the things you can do in the sort of Wang model is to give it much more noise, so you have much more spontaneous activity. And then what helps you to switch between the tracks? It's the noise. Okay. So in a sense, you don't need the oscillation to make you switch. It's extremely attractive because of the way we do that. And let me say, the other thing we think of historically with that is adaptation. We know there's a bit of adaptation in the upstream neuron. And of course, after a little while, they help you to switch. So all I'd encourage you to do, I think, is to take it into a little bit more of a physiological machine.
I'm doing exactly that now.
Good. And then contrast the oscillation with the noise.
Okay, I think that's a great idea. That's a great idea. The networks I've been running now, the E cells, if you look at individual E cells, they have huge CVs because they're much bigger networks, and their ISIs are, you know, hundreds of milliseconds, but the population rhythm is very strong gamma. So, but I haven't, that's just a baseline gamma thing, and I haven't hooked it up with the attractor network yet, so I have to do that. But no, it's something that I am doing.
I thought you might find the argument why you need to slow in the AMI cells, because when you showed that you were changing the NMDA conductance, but that was also just changing the overall EI balance ratio, right?
Yeah, so you're probably right. You could probably compensate that with enough AMPA E to I. Yeah, I think you're right. What? Or tonic excitability. Well, it's like tonic excitability. That's right. It's like, or like changing GK leak or the inhibitory cells. There's lots of things. So, you know, the point is that it's there, and if you get rid of it, it will make them less excitable.
Even in some cases where you are classic dependent, the ketamine can make gamma go up. I'll post it right out there.
I'm sorry, what? That was past the sweet spot when there was too much.
Right, but that's still the NMDA reduction.
Yeah, rate. Yeah. You yeah.
You personally answered my question. It's about the ISIs of the excitatory neurons in your network versus biological network.
Yeah, these ones are extreme because they're small networks.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
That makes sense to me, but you made some comments early on about the stability of the attractor being, maybe I just heard you, being somehow related to the excitatory neuron
NMDA receptors.
Is that
absolutely?
Is that still true when you're talking about neurons that are actually excited?
Absolutely, because there's thousands of neurons, and so somebody is producing enough NMDA. If you look at the, essentially, if you look at the amount of input coming in these small networks, I have to boost the strength and the probability connections enough to, in a small network, to get it to hold up. But in a big network, if you look, there's still this nice tonic background level. Now, you don't, in fact, you don't, so the NMDA really does help a lot holding that up. Now, there are cases where you don't need it. people do have these asynchronous states where it stays up without NMDA.
How the time course of the NMDA channel relates to these, you know, hundreds of milliseconds ISI for one individual neuron, how that sort of supports that neuron participation.
There's another point too. In these models, there isn't much adaptation, and in the models that I've been doing more recently, in order to reduce to make the eye cells fire much more sparsely, I have much more adaptation in them, okay? And even though there's a lot of adaptation, that still there's enough guys coming on with the NMDA to stay up. The trouble with the AMPA is it just doesn't persist long enough, so it's almost like adding a tonic drive. John?
So in the entorhinal cortex, the hippocampus, prefrontal cortex, and striatum, it's very clear that different gamma cycles carry different information. So in terms of the way you put it, you get a switch on every gamma cycle from one attractor to another attractor. And so the question is, how do you get such rapid and reliable switching?
Oh.
And actually, there's a very simple answer, which is you just have one attractor stimulate in a unidirectional way the next.
So you have a cyclic thing, yeah.
Cycle, or you put an after hyperpolarization into the cell so that, in a sense, once the cell fires, it sort of turns itself off.
That's exactly right. That addresses his point. If you put an after hyperpolarization in these networks of, if you take here's a really simple thing to do. Take a big network of E cells, okay? Just drive them. You don't even have to have E to E coupling, but, you know, just drive them, okay? And have spike frequency adaptation in there. Oh, no, you do need EDE. You absolutely need EDE. Okay, no inhibition. Okay, what you get is these big bursts. Everybody turns on, and then they're all dead for a while, and then they turn on again, and they go at 5 hertz or 10 hertz because that's the time constant of your adaptation. Now, introduce one eye cell, okay, that, you can introduce a whole bunch of eye cells, but one eye cell, okay, that receives input from all the E cells, okay, and projects back to all those E cells, okay? Fast inhibition, okay? But it's inhibition to everybody. Adaptation is only on yourself, okay? That destabilizes that state, and it gives you this really cool clustered state where groups of neurons fire. If you look at the underlying rhythm, there's a beautiful gamma rhythm, but groups of cells are firing together only every 10 cycles, every 5 cycles or every 6 cycles. Okay, well, I guess one more, and then we can drink, right? Okay.
Let's have one more question.